Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
I'm Stan Wawrinka.
I'm Leighton Hewitt.
I'm Andy Murray.
This is Yannick Noah.
Hi, this is Leslie Nash from Dunedin, New Zealand. I am a huge rapper fan from way back, and you are listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, thank you very much, Leslie, from New Zealand, nominated by listener Carl Solomon. Now, Matt, do explain to me what relation Leslie is to Carl, because I'm trying to get my head around it.
Leslie is Carl's grandmother-in-law.
Right.
And as we heard, she's a big Rafael Nadal fan, and Carl tells me that he had the pleasure of taking Leslie to Roland Garros a couple of years ago to see Nadal play for the first time. So a special moment they shared there.
What a fantastic story. That's lovely. Well, I hope you're listening, Leslie, and I hope you enjoy the show, and it's lovely to have you introducing us. And thank you for your support, Carl. Catherine, you all right?
Yes, I'm fine. I must put a disclaimer on my contributions, as they might have sort of some dog sound effects in the background. She's wrestling with something.
Okay, right. Well, we'll deal with that. That's fine. And then my printer might start, obviously, because it's homeschooling day, and my son doesn't seem to have got the gist yet. And I haven't got the lock sorted on the door. But anyway, we will crack on. It's that kind of Australian Open, really, isn't it? Let's be honest, nothing's normal. It should have been over by now already.
Yeah. Do you remember a couple of days ago when we were decrying how many tennis matches there were and how many events there were and how difficult it was to keep across it all and how we couldn't possibly register the names of them all and get them all right? Well, be careful what you wish for is the lesson we've learned.
We do seem to be going from one ridiculous extreme of loads of tennis right at the start of the year to absolutely nothing for 2 weeks and loads of tennis, and now everything stopped again.
Yes, yes, we might have to call this podcast Melbourne Mayhem Relived.
If you don't know what we're talking about, because you haven't really been following it that closely, I mean, today was supposed to be our draw reaction show. Well, that's for the Australian Open. The draw hasn't taken place yet. The draw is now going to be tomorrow. And bless him, Craig Tiley said, oh, it'll be sometime at 2 or 3 in the afternoon. Don't really know when yet. But I'll let you know when we've decided. Because he's had a bit of a day, has Craig, and as have everybody at the Australian Open and the lead-up events and everybody involved in Tennis Australia and obviously the state of Victoria, because they are approaching the coronavirus very, very differently to certainly how we have in the UK and how many of our listeners have told us about and we've seen on the TV, obviously, in the US. And it's a zero tolerance rule towards the discovery or positive testing of anybody with COVID-19. And that is what happened, I guess, 24 hours ago from when we record, that news came through that a hotel worker had tested positive in the Grand Hyatt Hotel. Somebody who, and that's the official hotel, one of which many, many players are staying at and are regarded in the words of Tennis Australia and the Victorian government, as casual contacts, therefore. And what that's meant is that 600 people were required to isolate until they received a negative test. So mass testing has gone on today in Australia. Craig Tiley speaking a couple of hours ago, the tournament director at the Australian Open, and saying that they'd got through about two-thirds of their tests. So far, none of them had tested positive, the players and their support teams, from what we understand anyway, and those are filtering out throughout the day. We'll have to wait and see, but yeah, they've put the draw back until tomorrow. But it basically means, Catherine, that there is no play today in Australia whatsoever. All those six events remain where they were 24 hours ago in terms of their draw positions, and it's now a really tight squeeze logistically for the tournament to get played before the Australian, which is, as Craig Tiley said, still scheduled to be played on Monday. And equally, and understandably, the locals in Victoria are more concerned now.
Yeah, and frankly, if the scenario ends up being that one day's play is cancelled and everything resumes as planned tomorrow and the draw goes ahead a day later than scheduled, that will be an absolute triumph as far as I'm concerned, and I'm sure as far as Tennis Australia are concerned. There are a lot of worst case scenarios than that. We haven't been presented with a scenario of what happens if any of those 600 plus tests is returned as positive. I suspect that decision, that scenario, would not remotely be in the hands of Tennis Australia. That would be in the hands of the Victorian Premier and the health authorities. Albeit, I'm sure, with some pleading and cases being made on behalf of Tennis Australia. But that is the unknown and the teetering on the edge of a cliff type scenario at the moment. Does everybody suddenly become deemed a close contact? Do they get upgraded from casual contact to close contact if one of them tests positive? And if so, the wording of the rules state that close contacts have to immediately self-isolate for 14 days, regardless of any test results. Because, of course, this 26-year-old worker at the Grand Hyatt, he returned a negative test throughout his period working there, and at the end of his quarantine, he is only subsequently tested positive after showing symptoms once out in the community. And as the Victorian Premier was very frank about in his press conference on, what would it have been, Wednesday night Australian time, nothing says don't panic like calling a 10:30 p.m. press conference. He said, look, there will be other cases. This guy's been out in the community. You know, they listed the places he'd been, luckily without revealing his identity, because it sounded like he'd been having a great time. Golf club, restaurants, all over the shop. I thought, oh, I want to be living this guy's life. And we know how infectious the virus is. There are going to be other cases. And I can only imagine what a tremendous source of worry that is for Melburnians. I mean, we're talking about a place where one single case is a big deal. One single case results in a 10:30 p.m. emergency press conference. So the inevitability of there being further cases will make everybody very jumpy. And I think, you know, assuming the Australian Open does go ahead as planned, as I say, that's best case scenario. I'd be surprised if it didn't impact crowds and so on.
Yeah. I mean, as we've talked about previously, I think we talked at the start of the week how quiet it seemed really in the stadia compared to what I think maybe we were expecting, especially after seeing the pictures in Adelaide and the full house there. But a lot of the stands have been fairly quiet. Now, there are lots of reasons for that, including the fact that schools have gone back now, that it's not holidays that it would normally be during the Australian Open in January. Yeah, I mean, exactly the reasons, difficult to know. They're still hoping that they get good crowds, and they're saying they think they will for the Australian Open. But who knows, Catherine, you may well be right that this just changes people's feeling ongoing, and you would understand that, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I was doing some research yesterday into the Olympics and sort of the current current state of play with that and whether it will go ahead, sort of kind of with the mindset of thinking the Olympics and the IOC must be looking very closely at the Australian Open, because it's probably as close at the moment to a kind of guinea pig situation as we've had in terms of how international the sport is, bringing in people from all over the world and hundreds, if not thousands of them. Now, obviously, the Olympics would be a completely different scale up altogether, but I think it's the closest we've had so far. And it must be making them jittery. And there are other comparisons as well. You know, I read that polls in Japan showed the vast majority of the population are opposed to the Olympics going ahead. They don't want it. And that's in spite of the money that's obviously already been spent on the venues and everything associated with hosting the Olympics. There would obviously be massive downsides to it not going ahead. And yet still... that's what the polls show. You know, it's possible, you know, the situation and the temperature with regards to COVID-19 is so different depending on where you are in the world. And we've seen evidence of that with how badly some players misjudged their approach to being in quarantine and what they said publicly about that. And it's possible that we've all, and maybe even Tennis Australia, I don't know, have misjudged the public feeling about COVID-19 and about this event going ahead in this climate. I don't know because I'm not there, but I can see how it would be easy to have to have misjudged it.
No, I don't envy them the challenge that they have. There's also a story that has been revealed this morning that the hotel quarantine worker worked with 60 people that gathered, he didn't gather apparently, but they gathered to celebrate the end of the Australian Open quarantine period in a St Kilda hotel. And the organisers of that party were COVID Quarantine Victoria. No rules were broken in doing that. But again, it just heightens the anxiety, I think, more generally of who else has been in contact with him? And I guess we're only going to find out in due course if and how much that has repercussions. Where that leaves the tournaments, Matt, is something I've been trying to get my head around today, because we've got six tournaments going on here, and now there's one day less in which to play them all. So these courts for tomorrow now with their new scheduling are... I mean, they're already pretty jam-packed, but it's more so than ever now, isn't it?
Yeah. Join the club, trying to get your head around it all.
Enjoy that question, Matt. I'll just sit back. I got the easy COVID-19 questions.
I always give Matt the one where you've got to come out with the detail.
What we know is that the two ATP events are at the last 16 stage, and certainly the two WTA events, which aren't the hard quarantine event, they're at the quarterfinal stage. And all of those quarterfinals, I believe, are taking place on one court tomorrow. There's eight matches on one court, whereas the men tomorrow, a lot of them are scheduled twice. So they'll play their last 16 in the morning and then come back in the afternoon and play their quarterfinals. So yeah, they are playing catch up. They've brought in a measure on the WTA side only. We understand that the deciding set won't be a full set. It will just be a match tiebreak instead. Don't think that has been replicated on the ATP side. And then with regards to the ATP Cup, that does slightly further complicate things, because that competition is taking up two of the covered courts at Melbourne Park, the Rod Laver Arena and the John Cain Arena, formerly known as the Melbourne Arena.
And the rest.
Yeah. So that sort of limits what matches can be played on those courts. And the weather is another factor in all of this, as it so often is when scheduling matches. David, you put on Twitter that the Melbourne weather tomorrow, Friday, looks sort of Solly Hullian.
It ain't good,
Dan Evans is flexing his muscles as we speak.
And there is a suggestion that they might have to put some of the matches on some indoor sort of training facility courts that they have.
Yeah.
So it's all incredibly complicated and, I mean, even more incredibly complicated and jam-packed than it already was.
Before we came on air for the last podcast, David, you made it wasn't a sort of definitive opinion, but you sort of threw out the discussion point of whether or not these build-up events this week should have ranking points attached to them. And I do now come back to thinking about that and think we're kind of in a worst of both worlds situation with that, in that I do think they are perhaps somewhat hamstrung by the fact that these events all have ranking points attached, because they are forced to have to clutch to a certain amount of legitimacy, but also they are having to compromise and sacrifice a certain amount of legitimacy, you know, with these two events on the WTA side now having match tie breaks. It does feel like a slightly flexible sway with the wind type situation. Mm. Now, that's what has to happen in these current times, you know, that makes sense. I understand why they're doing it, but it does raise slight consistency and legitimacy questions on the rankings point front. Although you could make the case that the rankings are just such a mess at the moment. I mean, with each passing week and month, we are slightly decreasing how much weight we give to the rankings, aren't we? Because they are so COVID impacted.
Yeah. And I guess, is it better for players to play events with compromised format and have ranking points that feel a little bit iffy, or play events that don't have any ranking points at all?
Yeah.
I think they would probably prefer the former, you know, that given they've gone over their ranking points is, you know, it's what they trade in, isn't it? It's fundamental to them, I think.
On the whole, I would prefer this, I think.
Mm.
The reason I raised it is because I of the same reasons a week ago. There is quite a lot of leeway within the rule book, I think, when I've seen in the past that they can alter things a little bit in order to make it work, and just time wise and stuff. It does feel weird, and it's a shame that it's not consistent with both the tours doing this in a way.
Mm.
But I feel like if you made it exhibition, I think that there is a danger that some take it seriously and some don't. And it could be hit and giggle for some, and I'm not sure whether that would be satisfactory.
But do you go to Australia, quarantine for 2 weeks in order to play a slam, and treat your 1 week of warm up as a hit and giggle, ranking points or not?
No, I know what you mean.
It would put a few more options on the table for the next few days. I'm kind of playing devil's advocate here. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but it would put more options on the table for the next few days if it were if they were exhibitions. But I don't know.
I think we sometimes see this in doubles, where players sign up to play the doubles and then it gets a bit inconvenient and then they just pull out, don't they? I always feel a bit unsatisfied with that, really. Same time, this is just... I don't know how these organisers are putting on these things. I don't know how... Having been somebody who works at tennis tournaments, I don't know how Craig Tiley's handling this. I really don't. I saw him at that press conference this morning, and he's talking about getting calls in the night from players and talking about how supportive people have been. But I'm just trying to get my head around how he's still coping, really, to this point. I mean, there's still 2.5 weeks left yet. And the premiere the other night, the way they speak, it is a mind-bending feat, really.
For the first time, I thought Craig Tiley looked a little bit ropey. He's been so good at just maintaining this kind of impervious-looking, unflusterable exterior. And he didn't look at all flustered in his press conference, but I just thought, appearance-wise, he did look like a man who had slightly better periods in his life, perhaps. I mean, haven't we all?
Actually, despite all the problems they've had with putting this event on and the sort of extraordinary efforts they've had to go to put these events on, to me, this is what tennis in a pandemic should look like in terms of get the players to one location and stay there and play as many tournaments as you can in that hub. Yes, it's weird. Yes, it's not ideal. But actually, the experience of watching it is quite a good one. There's so much going on when you do watch. And it strikes me as the safest way to do it. Obviously, I know there's all sorts of other interested parties, and holding all the tennis in one place is very difficult to do and so forth. But this, to me, is how tennis should look. I feel a lot more comfortable with this than I did when they were just gallivanting around Europe at the end of last season, sort of going from country to country. And I know it's very difficult on the people of Melbourne and Australia, and I fully respect and admire their approach to coronavirus. But if you can get tennis all in one place, I do think that is the better format at the moment.
Mm. Motion to move all tennis for the remainder of the year to the Maldives, and we'll all just decamp there. If that's what you're proposing, Matt, then yes, please.
Let's talk a bit about the tennis that we have had since Monday's show, because there has been quite a lot of it, which I've watched at some bizarre times of the day and night here. Found some very good highlight services on the WTA's YouTube channel. They've got, Matt alerted me to the fact that they've got 3-minute highlights of each match, and I was just wading through these matches and catching little snippets here and there. But I mean, first of all, where are we with the ATP Cup? I mean, I really have no clue. Has anybody gone to the semi-finals or something?
Yes, and right. Some teams have also been eliminated.
Yeah, so Russia and Italy are through. Russia with Medvedev and Rublev, such a strong team. We know how we know how strong Rublev is against anyone ranked below him. He just beats them. And pretty much most of the number two players are ranked below Rublev, so he's the kind of perfect guy to complement Medvedev, who's been playing very well. And Italy are through. Matteo Berrettini has been somewhat of a revelation. He's following all of Mary Carrillo's rules. He's holding his serve. He's showing his strength. And crucially, he seems to be covering his weaknesses, which we've talked about before. And he beat...
So his backhand is the weakness, right?
Yeah, and maybe movement a little bit as well. But, I mean, he's just taken those out of the equation and just... I mean, he absolutely dominated team and dominated Monfils. So Italy and Russia are through. Greece need to beat Spain 3-0, but, I mean, that ain't happening. So,
what are you trying to say about don't know his first name, Pavlarakis?
Saying that he's not beating Pablo Carreño Busta.
He's going to have the day of his life!
And the winner of Serbia-Germany will go through from the other group.
Right. Yes, I've seen poor old Denis Shapovalov.
Pervlarakis. Mikhail Pervlarakis.
Yeah. Okay. Got that. Denis Shapovalov played Djokovic the other day, didn't he? And had two very tight sets of tennis. So I think he lost them both 7-5. And then he lost, I think, 7-6 in the third set tiebreak to Zverev in the tie against Germany.
It was all very Shapovalov, wasn't it?
It was all very Shapovalov and very Djokovic. The match was just a microcosm of their careers, really. It perfectly illustrated everything you need to know about those two players. I mean, Shapovalov played some fantastic tennis. I mean, just really good. And yet Djokovic is kind of the nightmare opponent for him. The way that I always think Djokovic is so on balance, and Shapovalov is a tennis player who's quite off balance a lot of the time, leaning backwards, falling backwards. He was put in awkward spots by Djokovic quite a lot. And then obviously the climax of both sets was where it really played out their differences. Shapovalov got a little bit loose, started making some errors, and Djokovic knuckled down and managed to grab both sets.
He makes players like Shapovalov live right on the edge, doesn't he, Djokovic? And that can be great to watch for periods, but when you're right on the edge and it gets really tight, it's too easy to fall over the edge. He tempts them over the edge, doesn't he? Just right at the crunch point of the set.
Yeah. So where else are we? We haven't even had Nadal play. He's been injured, hasn't he?
Yes, he...
We've had Nadal, just not playing.
Very good alternative to watching Nadal play tennis is watching Nadal watch tennis. And we have been reminded of that this week because he's sat on the sidelines. He has a stiff back, I think, is what he said. So he didn't play against, who was it, Australia. And he's not on the schedule tomorrow either to play against Greece, which, I mean, has to be a concern. I mean, we know Nadal is quite cautious, but we also know he likes playing matches. So it's kind of it's a difficult one to really tell where he is, but it's certainly a concern. But instead, we've seen Nadal sort of... I don't think he's the official Spain captain, but he's the Spain captain. sort of the way he is giving amazing face and amazing reactions to everything, every tiny little moment that happens. He lets you know exactly how he's feeling about it. We've been watching with our Australian Open series accreditation, we can watch just a feed of these matches without commentary on. And for me, that's kind of the perfect way to follow this event because the microphones pick up everything that's being said between the players and the captains, both during the changeovers and during the points. You know, you can absolutely hear everything. And Nadal is non-stop talking. I mean, I was watching him follow the Bautista Agut match, and I mean every single point he was giving some instruction in Catalan to Bautista Agut, and just a fascinating to then contrast that with Dumanor, who's receiving really sort of positive, upbeat instructions from Leighton Hewitt and John Millman.
Come on mate,
yeah.
every point like as opposed to what?
Just a totally different energy to what Nadal is giving in his boxes. That for me is my favourite part of that event. I think the dynamic between the player and the teams. It's very interesting.
It makes me feel like I can speak Catalan because I know everything Nadal is saying just from his face.
are you following the conversations fluently, Matt?
I actually had a different experience to Catherine. It made me realise that I can't speak Catalan. Despite studying it and living in Barcelona for a little while, Nadal speaking Catalan very quickly is not an easy thing to follow. But I can certainly get the gist of what he's saying.
Via the eyebrows.
Via the eyebrows.
do you feel like when you go in his press conferences and you stay for the Spanish section, do you feel like you pick up something else from him and a different person in any way or more texture?
Yeah, he's just able to break down matches in a lot more detail in Spanish. I mean, I would say Nadal speaks English fairly fluently because my definition of fluency is really being able to get your personality across and make yourself understood, and he certainly can do that in English, but you don't often get much sort of real breakdown of a point or a match, whereas he can do that in Spanish, and he just offers, I think you just realize what a tennis mind he has and how he remembers everything, all the details he can really put across in Spanish. So I always, well, when we used to go to press conferences, I would always stay on for the Spanish section, not because I got a sense of a different person, but just because he offered so much more detail. And I think it's interesting to follow if you can. And it's not just Nadal. There's lots of other players who I'm sure offer that in their native language. And frankly, I find the level of English on the tennis tour to be extraordinary, really. The fact that these players give post-match interviews in English and have to grapple with both their emotions and trying to speak clearly about a match they've literally just played. I'm sort of constantly in awe of the linguistic capabilities. I think when you can listen to someone in their own language, there's always a lot to be gained from that.
Should probably give a notable mention to Alex Dumanor, who is enjoying coaching coming at him from two different directions in two different languages during the ATP Cup, because his coach, of course, is Spanish, and de Menor is completely fluent in Spanish, but he's also got Leighton Hewitt barking in his left ear and John Millman just being relentlessly upbeat behind him. He's also being like a stroppy teenager in Spanish with his coach. It's quite a sort of management job he's got going on.
That's great. I think Tsitsipas and de Menor was one of the other matches that I managed to see some of. Tsitsipas won it in the end, didn't he? But it was, and I mean, he was brilliant at times, Tsitsipas, certainly in the first set, but de Menor came back at him. I just don't feel like the order is any different right now. I don't know about you. I don't feel like things have changed. When we talked about Shapovalov, it's classic Shapovalov. Mm. It's classic Djokovic. I don't feel like anybody's gone away into this off season that I can sense and that I feel things are different. You know, I still would put Medvedev slightly ahead of Tsitsipas in the pecking order, behind those top two or three, and with team in there. You know, are you getting any different vibes from anybody at all in that regard?
No, I completely agree with you, David. I think the order feels reasonably set at the moment. A little bit of jostling behind those top players. For example, I thought de Menor had a shot of beating Tsitsipas, and yet Tsitsipas sort of confirmed himself as slightly ahead of de Menor in that pecking order. So no, I agree. I forgot how testy the ATP Cup was. A lot of shouting, a lot of screaming.
Heightened by the mics or just generally?
I think just generally. I think just when they get in that team environment, there's a sort of mac show element to it. And I mean, Shapovalov in particular, he's difficult to comprehend a little bit at the moment. He's very set on his sort of zen-like state during the changeovers. And then he comes onto court, and I mean, almost after every point, he's screaming. It's a little bit uncomfortable to watch, but but his tennis has been pretty good. So I'd say it's working. He's moving in the right direction.
I wonder whether he would be better off carrying himself in a different way.
Maybe. You know, I think he's trying, but
it's difficult to know, really, that, isn't it? By the way, just in terms of the ATP Cup, I feel like it. I mean, this is a wholly unsatisfactory few days generally, because it can't be what it wants to be and what everybody would hope tennis to be. We've got to make do, really. The massive own goal, I think, was starting on day one with all four players on the court in red shirts and white shorts, which Pam Shriver noticed when they played the doubles, Canada against Serbia. And it just feels like one of those things that surely that can be sorted out somehow with an away kit.
Yeah, it felt like a satire. It was that ludicrous. I mean, it's you know, of all the things that we're contending with, we should take the easy wins
yeah.
where we can, and that is easy win.
In other ways, I mean, yeah. It really is a well presented event, and you're right. I mean, they've ramped up those mics, and it's definitely enhanced the experience. Generally speaking, I'm more interested in women's tennis at the moment, because I feel like there are so many people that are right in that top echelon of players and jostling. And I don't really know. I don't feel any great confidence about who's going to come out on top. The one big disappointment from when we were speaking the other day is that Bianca Andreescu didn't end up playing at all. A little bit like Nadal, you take on face value what you're being told, that she just, I mean, she was supposed to be in the hard quarantine tournament, wasn't she? But the fact that she's going to go into the Australian Open in theory and just literally not play a tennis match is not ideal.
For over a year.
Yeah. So you wonder, I hope she's okay, really. I mean, we just don't know that.
Yeah. It was a slightly strange statement, I thought. I mean, it was encouraging on the one hand, because it didn't appear as though she had an injury. It appeared that the reasoning behind it was that she felt like training would be better preparation for the Australian Open.
Maybe preventative then.
Perhaps, yeah.
You know, get the body right, having done 2 weeks of hard quarantine, maybe if she can just build herself up, she might feel there's more cushioning there in order to stop a big issue when the tournament gets going. So let's hope it's that. I saw the first of Iga Świątek's matches at her tournament. She went a set down to Kaya Juvan and lost that set 6-2. And it was an absolute pummeling. And Juvan just seemed to be reading the game of Świątek. And then she turned it around and she won it easily, but lost in the second round pretty handily, Świątek. Do you have any views on... I mean, I was sort of watched that first set and I couldn't help but jump into conclusions that, oh, is she going to be one of the ones that struggles to cope with all the eyes on her, with all the expectation, with suddenly the interests of sponsors and the opportunity she has and still come out every time and play to her best and with the target on her back and all the rest of it? Do we just not have enough data at this stage to answer that? Because I couldn't help being just a little bit... I hadn't really thought about it before, but I was a little concerned watching her this week.
I think it's too early for concern. I really do.
It's not much data, is it?
Yeah.
This is unusually pessimistic of you, David.
I don't know.
He really looks edgy.
I'm jumpy.
You are.
Can I say?
There's a lot of extenuating circumstances, I would say, and... I mean, one of those is she's using a new racket.
Is she?
Yeah, she's switched from Prince. I think she was using a Prince racket at the French Open. She's now using Technifiber.
Ooh.
And I think she used to use Technifiber as a junior, and she is familiar with those rackets, and I'm sure she'll have done all the appropriate testing and whatever. But I mean, that is a transition that always makes me, to use the word, a bit jumpy anyway. I mean, I remember Djokovic going through a couple of years after his breakthrough slam. He switched from Wilson to Head, didn't he? And I mean, there were lots of other things going on, but that was one of the adjustments he had to make. Just watching Świątek, I think, was an adjustment I needed to make, because the last time we saw her play was 4 months ago, and she played the most flawless tennis imaginable. And I think that has stuck in my mind, because that was the last time I saw her play. But of course, she can't always play like that. It was sort of normal that she would not produce that incredible level again. I'm not sure it necessarily points to, oh, she's not coping with it at all well.
And we'd seen so little of her before that fortnight of perfect tennis. It was just like, oh, well, pretty much everything I've seen of Świątek is winning Grand Slams without dropping a set. So this is what happens then.
Yeah.
I need to calm down then, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Listen to Taylor Swift. You need to calm down.
Yeah, worked for Billie Jean this week in the car.
It did.
Knocked a spark out.
Mm-hmm. Little bit of folklore.
But, you know, it's certainly a situation to monitor, and because it could happen. There's plenty of examples of it happening.
The racket thing worries me a bit. Does that look like a commercial contract that she's taken on?
Yeah.
Right. Because, I mean, I go back to remembering Merit Safin doing it after winning the US Open. And I think a couple of years ago, Karen Khachanov changed his, and it just seems to... I mean, it's such a personal thing, isn't it? The racket you use. Anyway, I need to stop this. I need to get out of this frame of mind because it's bothering me. What about other players you've seen this week? Serena Williams is still going. She's looking pretty good, I think. Naomi Osaka beat Katie Bolter, who's had a cracking start to the year. Katie Bolter, she beat Coco Gauff, and she won one in the first round as well, and then won the first set against Osaka. I didn't see that match, but I think either one or both of you did.
I did, yeah. I stayed up late to watch that one. And it was really interesting, actually. I mean, Katie Bolter knew she just had to go for it. I mean, that is her preferred game style anyway. But she obviously knew, you know, let Osaka take control and get me on the run, and I've got no chance. So to see someone like Katie Bolter come out and be the aggressor and the bigger hitter against Naomi Osaka was really quite something, and it was a thrill to watch. Ultimately, she couldn't maintain it, and Osaka definitely upped her levels. Osaka was patchy in the first set, I would say. Bolter's serve let her down on a few occasions, and Osaka sort of failed to capitalise. A fantastic competitive performance from Naomi Osaka, and really showed commitment and desire, and did that champions thing of improving through the match. And the third set did have a slight feeling of inevitability about it. And look, Naomi Osaka is a better tennis player, and as impressed as I am with Katie Bolter, it's unlikely that she has the potential anything like a Naomi Osaka. So the fact that she was genuinely competitive for that period was very impressive, really very impressive. And it was just a really enjoyable set of tennis to watch her go at it like that against three-time Grand Slam champion.
Was that a doorbell?
Yeah. So.
Well, she's ripped the post to shreds.
What you got? Who was it?
That was Amazon delivering a heater.
Right. Okay. I wonder why you were wearing about six layers. Anyway.
Yes, but I discovered a pile of post on the floor from the Royal Mail, and most of it had been eaten and ripped to shreds.
That is
yes, my Investment Times catalogue is barely legible. So I have to find something else to do with my afternoon.
Right, okay. Johanna Konta had a bit of a heartbreaker. I mean, I didn't see it, but
are you projecting,
word.
David?
What? I'm just sort of, you know, looking at the scoreline, and it was 4-6, 7-6, 7-6, and three and a half hours. And I was thinking, and I did think, oh, glad I didn't sit through that. That sounds like an absolute ordeal. She lost to Irina Camelia Begu. And yes, I am projecting, because I picked Konta to win the title in newsletter, which you can sign up to if you like. And just laugh at my expense on a weekly and daily at the Grand Slams basis. Arina Sabalenka, who I said would win a Grand Slam title this year, has just had her 15-match streak, winning streak, ended by Kaya Kanepi. And I did see some of that, and it was hilarious. Because you know how Sabalenka likes to come out and just seek and destroy. And Kaya Kanepi walks out, and physically she's a match for her, and she just couldn't have looked less bothered, quite honestly, Kaya Kanepi. And yet she's 5-love up after about 20 minutes. And the scoreline went 6-1, 2-6, 6-1 in the favour of Kaya Kanepi, which is probably the most predictable thing about it, was the lopsided nature of all three sets.
Just very quickly on Begu, she was in Adelaide quarantine, wasn't she? Because she was Halep's hitting partner there.
Oh.
So it doesn't surprise me that she's having a good run.
There'd be some quite good stats to keep across on, really, wouldn't there? Those that were in the lovely Adelaide quarantine, those that were in the sort of normal Melbourne quarantine, and those that were in the hard can't leave your room quarantine.
And we will be keeping across them.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode, and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast. alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
What about your new spot, Matt, from last year, Carlos Alcaraz?
Not last year, David.
Was it the year before?
It was
The year before that.
Oh, goodness. Okay, where did you spot him again?
At the Barcelona tennis tournament in April 2017.
And he was about 12.
Yeah.
I mean, genuinely.
Yeah, I think he was 13.
Was he? I was kind of joking.
Yeah, he was 13. He was playing a junior event. He wasn't playing the actual men's ATP event. He was playing a junior event. I watched him there in the final. And the messages I sent that day are the messages that have aged better than any message I've ever sent, because I just remember being so completely overwhelmed by how good he was at 13 and how complete he looked. And now here he is. He really does appear to be, well, the real deal.
You had a bit of a watch along, you two, didn't you? Because I kept getting, I came back to my phone and there were like 64 unread messages where you're talking about, I mean, it sounds like, you know, he's a combination of Leighton Hewitt, Roger Federer, Rafael Nadal and Pete Sampras all in one. tell me, Catherine, what did you see?
I saw him beating the top seed in the Great Open Road Murray River Open Trophy.
Mm, okay.
David Goffin in straight sets. I mean, it wasn't particularly close. Alcaraz... It was never close. No, Alcaraz was just so much better. David Goffin looked like bad Superman. I mean, David Goffin, who's looked like a 17-year-old boy band member for the entirety of his adulthood, suddenly had stubble, and it was very disconcerting.
This is Superman 4, right?
Superman 4, yeah.
And it was starting to get a bit ropey.
Yeah, where he goes to the bar and, you know,
he's
anyway.
Down in shots and smashing them to bits.
Yeah, it was like that.
Stubble.
But it was kind of fitting because I can imagine being beaten that handily by a 17-year-old would make you want to rip off your Superman shirt and head to the bar and do shots. I mean, I'm just going to copy what Matt said 4 years ago now, but I couldn't believe how complete he was.
Why is he good?
Because everything he does is a weapon. I mean, even his volleys and his net approaches are so good. And
you said he chipped charged.
He chipped and charged and just knew exactly what he was doing. Didn't have any, you know, I think we've talked a bit here and there about how this new generation, not going to say next gen, I mean, I've said it now, coming through, are more willing to serve and volley. And that's great. And I like to see it. But it so often has a slightly experimental feel about it, a kind of learning on the job feel about it. If I keep doing this, then my volleys will get better, right? But he just could do it so well, you know. And I'm not, you know, he wasn't drop volleying Pete Sampras at Wimbledon style. But, you know, serve and volleys, chip and charge, looking to finish points off quickly. Obviously, just a magnificent forehand. I mean, I can't think of a weakness. I really can't. He looks like a perfect specimen. I mean, obviously he has one because he's not winning Grand Slams. But I think he will be. Something would have to go wrong.
Mm. He's got an incredibly fast arm, and the power he generates on that forehand is remarkable. He's really out of his, well, what you would think of his comfort zone. He's played very little on hard courts. He's really played mostly on clay. I don't think he's ever won he's never really won anything significant on hard court. It was quite a feat for him to even qualify. And he was in 14 days hard quarantine. And he's gone from that to, I mean, destroying David Goffin, as Catherine has described. And Goffin seemed completely bewildered in his press conference about how good Alcaraz was. He was as impressed as anyone.
Hmm. So what you're saying, Matt, is when I was considering whether to go for Concert, Świątek or Alcaraz for my week's pick, I should have gone for Alcaraz.
Well, considering he's the only one left in the tournament.
Catherine's not happy that I've tried to
hedge it out.
Yeah, tried to get some sort of credibility out of this pathetic week of predicting. Nick Kyrgios, I mean, do you know, I'm struggling already with Nick.
You're peeved,
really.
Don't you?
You are.
I'm a bit. I just... Maybe
but it's the same.
I'm not ready for it.
Are you peeved because it's the same?
I don't know. I suppose I kind of feel like, come on, you can't be getting wound up.
He never promised it would be different, did he?
From what I can see, I didn't see all the match that he had, but he had a time violation called on him when he was mid-serve, didn't he, when the shot clock rolled down just as he's throwing the ball up, which did seem a bit extreme. But at the same time, you know, didn't he call for the supervisor and he says, I'm not playing and all this sort of thing. And I don't know why, but at the moment I don't really want the circus like that. I don't know. There's too much other stuff to get through. We haven't got time for all that.
Feels like a luxury, or at least an indulgence.
I'm not going to lie. I had missed the feeling of being totally swept up by a slightly ridiculous Nick Kyrgios match. And those were very entertaining couple of sets he played. He had a point about the serve. The problem is, he should have left it there. The more he talked, the worse he made it. I really don't like the way he talks about umpires, as though they're he used the word an extra. He said they're an extra to make sure all of this just runs smoothly. And I really don't like that, especially now, as you say, David, when the umpires are making all the same sacrifices that the players are making to be on the tour and more. I mean, they're not getting, I'm sure, the same nice treatment that the top players are playing. They're getting it as hard as it gets, I'm sure. So I think a little bit more respect to them would be appreciated. But in terms of the actual tennis he put on, he's obviously making his first steps back. But there is so much to enjoy about the way he plays. I mean, he saved some set points with a sort of drop shot lob combination, and what crowd there was on that court were absolutely loving it. As Catherine says, it was the same. It was everything we've known Nick Kyrgios to be, and I guess I've just kind of accepted that now, and just trying not to want him to be something that he's not.
And
because we've had years of doing that,
the circus is so much worse when he plays lower ranked players. Yeah. It is. I think there's two layers to that. It's the how he deals with the pressure of being expected to win. It's a kind of deflection tactic from that, and it's also the, you know, struggling. He struggles to get pumped up for smaller billing matches. So he has to sort of find other ways to fire himself up. I'm not justifying that. You could interpret that as a sign of disrespect towards his opponent. But, you know, I would expect a still entertaining and eventful, but as a slightly more knuckled down performance if he ends up playing top players.
Well, he's got Borna Coric next, and that's the first match against someone who he had big beef with on Twitter, isn't it? Do you remember that
was
time?
Was it a big beef or some big beef?
It was a big beef.
A big beef. Yeah. My favourite kind.
Because
Coric had a bit of a pop back at him.
He did, and then I think instantly regretted it because, oh no, this is not me. What have I done?
It's really not him, is it?
No.
Well, they'll get a chance to have a physical pop at one another on the court. Yeah.
You're like aggro, David. I reckon you could get into that.
Yeah. I'll be all right, everybody. So I've just, you know, I'm a bit out of practice with all this. So I just need to calm down, just enjoy it. So anyway, we'll find out what the next few days have in store. We're going to be back tomorrow with another show, hopefully after the draw has been made, and we can have a look at that and talk about, you know, what to expect and everything. And then we'll have another show at the end of all these tournaments over the weekend. And then it's into daily editions of the Australian Open Tennis Podcast. So hope you're enjoying what you're hearing, and we'll be coming to you a lot over the next couple of weeks. Just before we go, you will recall that in the previous edition, we had said our intention is to refer to what is officially called the Margaret Court Arena as the Yvonne Goolagong Arena, because of our feelings of how we feel troubled by a lot of what she said over the years, without any acknowledgement of the hurt and the damage that it's caused to many people. It's an unofficial stance. It's something that we feel is a way for us to make our little stand on our show and say what we feel. And so that's what we decided to do. Now, we had a lot of reaction, a lot of it positive, a lot of people happy to see us stand up and say our piece and to make this point. Some people got in touch and didn't agree with it, and a lot of those ones that did write to us are listeners we've heard from before who are big supporters of us and people we enjoy hearing from, and we were certainly open to hearing feedback. Now, a couple of people had said that they felt that we were partaking in cancel culture, which I hate that idea. I certainly don't feel that that's what we're doing. I fully respect Margaret Court's achievements as a tennis player, and I hope she one day feels differently about the things that she said. I certainly don't see it like that. I don't know what you two feel about it.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a number of different reasonings behind the criticism of us for the decision that we've made. You know, some people have accused us of stifling freedom of speech. Well, I would point to a case that's been made by plenty of people, but there was a speech given by Sacha Baron Cohen at the Anti-Defamation League last year, and he said freedom of speech is not the same as freedom of reach. People can say whatever they like, but it's also up to us and decision makers and people with that power whether or not they provide a platform for that speech. And I believe that with naming that significant and prominent court after her, that is elevating Margaret Court's platform and therefore the platform from which she expresses her views. And that is what I'm deeply uncomfortable with. And I don't wish to cancel her voice. She's entitled to say whatever she likes, but I don't want to be part of amplifying that voice. And by that court bearing her name and us saying it every day, that is amplifying her voice, in my view. You know, we explained in the last episode that for us, given everything we've learned and have heard from so many greats, the naming of a stadium is about a lot more than just titles and achievements in the sport. If it were simple as that, then there would just be a formula for it, wouldn't there? You've won 12, you get the biggest court. You've won 9, you get the second biggest court. Done. It wouldn't be a decision-making process. So we're not cancelling her. Do people think that Yvonne Goolagong has been cancelled all this time because she hasn't had a court named after her? No. For us, it's about a lot more than just titles. And yeah, for those accusing us of being woke, that's fine. I'm proud to be woke. I think if you're considering woke to be an insult, then that's probably something you should look at. For me, woke means being awake to the realities of the world and the realities of privilege. And that is where I want to be. So thanks very much.
Yeah, I think that's very well said. I echo everything you've said. I think if ever there's an example of someone who hasn't been quote unquote cancelled, it is Margaret Court. Her name is still on that stadium, despite the things she has continually said and the way she's continually said hurtful things about LGBTQ people. This year, she was given the top award in the Australia Day Awards. Margaret Court has not been cancelled. You don't need to worry about her in that respect. We will continue to talk about her tennis. I'm sure she offers a very interesting place in tennis, especially given everything we've talked about recently in terms of history. How do you put her achievements in the context that's necessary without totally dismissing the career she had is a really interesting debate, and I'm sure one that we will come back to, and her name will come up. But exactly as Catherine said, what I think we're doing is purely about her name being on that stadium, and I think we've had problems with that for a long time. But through Tennis Relived and the research we've done, I've really come to realize the significance of a name being on a stadium and what that means and why it matters and why it's about much more than just the achievements. Arthur Ashe, his name is not on the biggest stadium in tennis because he won 3 Grand Slam titles. It's about the way he achieved that, what he had to overcome to achieve that, and his tireless activism on race relations and AIDS awareness. And we feel that Margaret Court having her name on that stadium gives weight to what she's saying and sends out a message that it's okay to think like that. And I'm sorry, but I really don't think it is. I don't think her homophobia can be normalized as just another opinion. It's not political correctness. It's not woke. It's just right. It's just right. These are people's lives. When she says things, she's denying them that part of their identity, their humanity. And we want to stop amplifying that, as Catherine said. So that's all this is. It's just a little stand we're making. And yeah, people might think we've overstepped the mark or it's high-handed of us. Okay, we can maybe have a conversation about that. But the actual point of taking a stand against what Margaret Court says, I fully believe we're within our rights to do that.
We're the ones that would have to say her name multiple times every single day. You know, think about that. I feel when it's not related to specifically her tennis achievements, I do feel it's within our rights to take a stand on that. And people saying you've got no right to do that. No, we've got no right to rename the arena. We are not doing that. We are adjusting how we refer to it.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Catherine. I think one other thing that one or two of our correspondents did say is that, or asked us, is whether we'd asked Yvonne Goolagong-Cawley's permission to do this. And, well, in all honesty, no, we hadn't. And I think it's a fair point. The reason we did this is because, in my view, it's an unofficial thing. It's our show, and we just want to pay tribute to somebody who we were inspired by in reading up on and covering her in Tennis Relived last week. That's the inspiration behind this. Aside from wanting to make the point that we're also making about the existing stadium name, but we feel that it's something that we can do just to show our respect and admiration for her and to pay tribute to her. and we are going to be back with another show tomorrow. Crikey, it's already coming around. Tomorrow. I tell you what, Chester's having a good week. The rescue cat from Battersea, that's our mascot for the week, is getting four shows, which is brilliant because Chester's lovely.
Chester's from Battersea.
Rescue cat from Battersea. Yeah. I've got written down here.
Lovely. Magic was from Battersea.
He's still alive. Simon Wood is the owner, who we know well.
Hello, Simon.
Is lovely. Rogue is also amazing. Rogue is sponsoring me. And Matt's got Scousel Mousel. And Catherine's got Zeus, which is just, I just love saying that name.
Me too. Also love saying Billie Jean King.
Yeah, Billie Jean King is sponsoring Billie Jean the dog. Billie Jean King, if you wouldn't mind having a word with Billie Jean about ripping up Catherine's mail, that would be useful. So, you know, trying to have a good influence. Chris Albert Lee is our executive producer, top bloke, and we much appreciate his support. And Matt, we have shout-outs.
We do. Shout-outs today are Nancy Dorr.
Ooh. All right, Nancy.
I really like the name Nancy. Makes me think of Oliver. Yes. Oliver Twist.
Yes, so thank you, Nancy. Also, Vikram Swaroop.
Oh, hello.
Vikram. That's a great name.
That is sensational. We could definitely be famous with that name.
There's a cricketer called Vikram, isn't there?
I think there's a lot of cricketers called Vikram.
Hmm. Who am I thinking of?
I don't know.
Who's Vikram Solanki?
Yes.
Yes.
He has retired.
Yes. Has he? I don't know much about cricket, everybody.
I think so.
Anyway, Vikram, thank you so much for your support.
And finally, Corinne Maybom.
What Hi, Corinne. Now?
Yeah, I have to apologise for the
as in like
for the pronunciations.
April bomb, June bomb.
Almost certainly butchering. M E I B O M.
Oh, I like that May a lot.
Bomb. That's so cool. What a cool name. Mm. Corinne, thanks ever so much for your support.
We've all got, apologies for this in advance, quite boring names.
Yeah.
Makes you realise, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Not memorable at all.
You know. Oh, well. What can I say? I can't. I mean, you know, could I have a really good nickname? Maybe I could have a really good nickname.
Didn't Daryl tell us an amusing nickname that you had at uni? I forgot.
All right, moving on. The Law.
I'm sure he'll be in touch.
Yeah, I think Law's quite a cool name.
Yeah, thanks, Matt. Brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, right. Well, we'll think about it, see if I can come up with anything else. Thanks ever so much for listening, folks. Catherine and Matt, it was a fun hour to spend in your company. We'll do it all again tomorrow. See you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.